Welcome to Notes from the Western Edge, a monthly half-hour on-demand webcast featuring musicians who create on the edges of jazz, new music, electronics, and a broad expanse of sonic spaces in between. This month, we hear from two musicians who first met in the hotbed of musical creativity known as the loft scene in 1970s New York City. Together, in 1977, they co-founded the legendary String Trio of New York. Along with a very select few, Billy Bang is one of the prime innovators on jazz violin. At age 21, after a tour of duty in Vietnam, Bang was searching for a musical voice. He tried flute, he tried drums, but ultimately he returned to the instrument he played only reluctantly as a child, the violin. From there, Bang has become a uniquely powerful presence within the world of creative music. In his early teens, John Lindberg came to the bass with such force and determination that he dropped out of high school to create his own path of learning. At age 16, he moved to the New York area to study with those whom he most admired, and soon was performing alongside them as well. Today, his jazz and his chamber music take him around the world as a bassist and as a composer. I hope you enjoy the show.
My name was a name actually given to me. I never wanted this name. I didn't even like this name to begin with.
So how did he get this name he didn't like?
I'm from Harlem and I'm from the Bronx. I was raised in Harlem, and then when I went away to private school, I came home. My mother was living in the Bronx. So I met the new guys in the neighborhood. I still went back to Harlem because of my old friends, but then eventually I stayed in the Bronx. And everyone up there had nicknames. You know, guys were named Peanut and Popcorn and Shorty and Blackie. I mean, everybody had one except me. I was just Billy Walker. So there was a cartoon that came on TV, and the host of the cartoon, it was called Billy Bang Bang and his brother Butch, and their wild western cartoons. And he would show cartoons, animated stuff or whatever. So the guys started calling me in the neighborhood Billy Bang Bang. So I kind of resisted. That's not my name, man. That's not my name. You know, yelling and screaming. But eventually it stuck with me. It went through high school. It went through the Army. It became more my name than my other name. So actually now I'm changing it officially.
Well, your drill sergeant wasn't calling you Billy Bang.
No, they Sergeant Walker then. And they weren't drilling either. Not in Vietnam. They were serious.
In 1967, like many men of his generation, violinist Billy Bang found himself at war in a far-off country called Vietnam. Some of his most recent music deals directly with his experiences in that war and their impact on his life. We'll hear more about that later. Right now, let's listen to Bang on violin, James Emery on guitar, and John Lindberg on bass, collectively known as the String Trio of New York, playing his Spacewalk from the 1981 album Common Goal on the Black Saint label.
I started out, as most violinists, learning classical music. But I started at a very, very early age. But to be very honest, I never bought into liking the violin. I didn't like the music. I didn't like carrying it. And I didn't like particularly carrying it in my neighborhood, where I lived in Harlem on 117th Street. The kids were pretty rough those days. And if you had a violin and it was short like I am, you asking for trouble, which I did get, but it made me a tougher guy, though. I can tell you that now. But I didn't really like the violin. I always wanted to go join my other partners who went to the band. they came out with mouthpieces and drumsticks and things. So I had this kind of like a weird relationship with the violin for a long time. But it was only until after I came out of the Army during a tour in Vietnam, and I was 21 years old, which is pretty old to get started for pretty much any kind of career, but particularly jazz, that I started playing the violin again. And it was just by happenstance that I came across it. And I sort of wanted to play music, period, just in general. So I tried the flute, I tried drums, but I knew for a fact that the only instrument that I had training in was the violin. Luckily, I did hear some violin music that kind of opened a door for me, which was, first of all, was the Latin violin, the charanga, and I heard the fire in the violin as opposed to what I heard from the European classical music. And then right after that, I heard Leroy Jenkins on some early Del Monk records, and I knew that was the way to go. So I had to double up my days to play catch up. In other words, if someone put an 8-hour day in, I put 16 minimum in, sometimes 24, 38 hours in 2 days to try to catch up to learn the music. I did, in fact, study with Leroy. That corrected a lot of the technical aspects that I had forgotten or needed to relearn or learn, period. And the other thing is I was with musicians in a place called The Bakery. We call it The Bakery. And it's so ironic that I'm here at the Jazz Bakery in Los Angeles. But this was a basement in New York. They called it The Bakery because everybody wanted to learn how to cook down there. I mean, musically. And I studied there with a clarinetist named Henry Warner. Leroy Williams was there. I had a lot of help from bassist Wilbur Ware. Wilbur Ware almost took me under his wing. He almost adopted me, in a sense, to really show me the way. And he was very helpful, and encouraging and musically helpful, because he would come by my apartment. I had a bass there. I had a violin and a bass, because I was also trying the bass, too, because the bass... We needed bass players in those days. I guess they always need bass players. So I was also doubling up on bass, but it was harder for me. I mean, not to reach, because the guys are shorter than me playing bass. I couldn't believe it, like Junie Booth and even Wilbur wasn't, but so big. But it wasn't that. It was I was more in tune to the violin or viola. But Wilbur would show me a lot, and we wouldn't read any music, so he strengthened my ears in the sense where we played some Duke Ellington music with no charts. And I kept saying, Wilbur, I need to see the notes. He said, man, forget that, man. Just listen, man. Check this out, listen. So I really did learn A-Train and Satin Doll directly from him. Thank you.
Jazz Bakery gig Bang mentioned was in November 2006 with Kayil El-Zabar's Ritual Trio. We're listening to that band right now, playing Bang's tune Freedom Flexibility from the 2004 CD Big M, a tribute to the late bassist Malachi Favors on the Delmark label. If you knew that Bang had played with Sun Ra off and on from 1982 to 1990, but hadn't heard much of Bang's own music, you might have thought that he is primarily a free jazz player, which is not at all the case. But it might surprise you to learn where Bang learned the most about playing over traditional chord changes.
The most ironic thing is I learned more about change playing with Sun Ra, with the Sun Ra Orchestra. Even though people don't believe that the orchestra does that, Sun Ra was very strict in the music. Then I found out later that he was an arranger for Fletcher Henderson, and I realized that he really knew what he knew. So he played a lot of Duke Ellington, played a lot of Walt Disney, played a lot of big band things that I had to learn how to listen and to hear that, because he wouldn't give me a lot of parts. He would allow me to do it on my own, and then sometimes he would give me something from the piano directly, and then other times I would go to the book and study so I could learn what to do. The first composition on Vietnam, The Aftermath, it's called Yo, Ho Chi Minh is in the house. And when I wrote this, I thought about the Vietnamese on the mountain playing their horns and about to charge us during Tet Offensive. And I tried to capture that musically. To make a long story short, I called Just In Time Records, which is my record label, and said, look, man, I'm in such a bad shape financially, or strapped here. I need to do a record, a CD. So I got one of the A&R people there, named Jean-Pierre Leduc, asked me, he told me, actually, we don't want to offend you, but would you consider doing a record about your experience in Vietnam? And I said, whoa, man, holy, that's sort of off limits. I don't really talk about this, you know. But because I was up against the wall, 3 days later, I called them back, and then I really told them yes. But there was a big but to this. I need to be financially settled right now, so I don't have to worry about rent or food or anything, at least for a month or 2 months. And they agreed. So, and they sent me in a big advance. And that allowed me to really focus and concentrate on this, on the writing of the music. When I wrote this music, I went back to 1967 in Vietnam, and I thought about the times that I was out on ambush, when I was taking out pulling point, taking out, going into the tunnels to find Vietnamese down there. I mean, I thought of everything, so I relived this. I cried, I remembered, I did everything. So a lot of the writing of the music, it was purely emotional. Nothing seemed to be contrived. It was really kind of going back in sort of a time machine in my brain, in my mind, and reliving that and trying to conjure that up and translate that into an artistic endeavor. And that's how Vietnam, The Aftermath came out.
Recorded in April 2001, Vietnam The Aftermath features 8 other musicians in addition to Bang, 5 of whom are military veterans. Portions of the proceeds from sales of this recording are donated to the Veterans Quality of Life Access Network, a nonprofit organization helping Vietnam veterans and their families. Garth Fagan choreographed a dance to music from this album, which he and Bang have performed together live as well. For Bang, the creation of this album was clearly therapeutic.
Because I had to relive it and revisit that area that I've been denying, I was in denial, that it really allowed me to feel the pain again, to kind of like, it was like almost a self, psychoanalytical approach I did. It was like me helping myself, really like facing up to the ugliness that I was carrying around and trying to hide deep inside of me. So when it came to the surface, when I actually conjured it up to it was like an exorcism. I got it out of me. I was getting it out of me. It's never completely gone, but it was enough that I can face the world brighter now. So then I started going to therapy. I wasn't afraid anymore.
Los Angeles, for Notes from the Western Edge, I'm Richard Paskey. John Lindbergh's path as a bass player didn't start out on the bass.
I originally started as a percussionist, playing like in school bands and marching bands, starting from like fifth grade on. And I went to a drum teacher, percussion teacher, who was a big jazz fan, but also just a fan of all new music. And I had really no exposure to anything outside of the mainstream. I knew, you know, traditional band music that I was being taught in school, and in fact at the time my personal tastes were like hard rock and heavy metal. I was listening to Deep Purple and Black Sabbath and stuff like that. And this guy one day, he says, well, here's a few records to take home, and he gave me kind of like a whole history of creative music, you know, I mean, from Louis Armstrong to the Art Ensemble of Chicago, from Edgar Varese to Chick Corea. I mean, I know those were four of the records he gave me, for example. So, like, my whole universe just opened up overnight.
Lindbergh moved from marching bands to jazz, but not on the drums.
And then I got more and more into listening to various jazz records. And in a very short time, I decided in my teenage mind, my adolescent mind, that what was really happening on these records was the bass players. That was like, wow, those were the guys that were really killing that music. So I went into the school and band teacher and said, you know, I want to switch the orchestra and can, you know, I just borrow bass and, you know, take your percussion stuff back. And they said, sure, do that.
So began Lindbergh's path as a bass player, which started out with some classical lessons, but soon moved to the edges of creative music.
At that same time, living in Michigan, was Roscoe Mitchell of the Art Ensemble of Chicago. And I called him up as a 15-year-old and asked him if, you know, he gave lessons. And he said, oh, you know, I don't really do that, but, you know, just come on over. So I started hanging out with him, and the whole AACM area of music and that way, that conceptual concepts they had of structuring improvisation and composition together opened my eyes to yet a new thing. And I realized I needed to get out of the small sphere I was in. And at 16, I went to Woodstock, New York, to the Creative Music Studio, which was run by Carl Berger.
Whom we're hearing right now on Vibes in duet with Lindbergh, recorded some 30 years after their first meeting as teacher and very young student. This is the Lindbergh composition 3337, recorded at the Clubhouse in Rhinebeck, New York. Lindbergh learned a great deal from Berger and many other resident artists at the legendary Creative Music Studio, but he had other goals in mind as well.
And also wanted to study with Dave Holland, who was living in Woodstock, and my main goal was to get down to New York City to study with David Eisenson, who would become like my main hero of the music.
At age 16 in 1975, that's just what he did. He
looked up David Eisenson, and at that time he wasn't teaching, and I was just, I was a squeaky wheel, and he finally said, all right, come on down. So I studied intensely with him for 2 years and became very close with him, and he died in 79, so I really only, I had an intense 2.5 years with him.
Very quickly, Lindbergh graduated from student to full participant in some of the most creative bands of 1970s New York City.
I also joined the Charles Bobo Shaw's Human Arts Ensemble, co-founded the String Trio in New York with James Emery, and at that time the violinist was Billy Bang, and shortly after joined the Anthony Braxton Quartet. So by the time I was 19, all that had happened, and my career in this music had started in a substantial way.
While working with Anthony Braxton, a new interest took root.
When I started to play with Braxton, I was 18 when I joined his quartet. That really fueled my desire to be a composer, and as well as a bass player and a composer-performer, where you're performing your own pieces. And he also had a great interest in so-called 20th century classical musicians, and talked to me a lot about Stockhausen and Pierre Boulez and composers from that genre. And that, so that was always something that interested me. And so I started to write some largely notated music starting maybe in the early 80s. And one of the first things was the trilogy of works for 11 instrumentalists that Braxton conducted in 1984. And then I had a commission from Westdeutsche Radio in Cologne, where I wrote my first totally notated string quartet.
We're listening to Land, The third movement of Lindbergh's first string quartet, The Arrival, on the German Between the Lines label. Lindbergh wrote this piece about the birth of his son in Newburgh, New York, while he was on tour in Europe. In the liner notes, Lindbergh writes that this movement expresses the pent-up wonder and glory of meeting his son for the first time when he returned home after his tour. During Lindbergh's 30-year career, he's worked with many of today's most creative improvisers. One of them is trumpeter Wadada Leo Smith.
Wadada Leo Smith, incredibly unique concept of space and sound. To me, he has the most powerful and unique trumpet sound. He plays one note, I know it's Leo, and his respect for using space and silence in the music and letting it breathe and develop in a very organic way is something that's always impressed me a lot, and I've learned a lot from him in that regard. And I think innately I have a similar thing, and that's why our connection has always been very strong on that level.
Lindbergh also has a long-standing relationship with the String Trio of New York, a group he co-founded in the summer of 1977 with violinist Billy Bang and guitarist James Emery. In the liner notes for Common Goal, recorded in 1981 in Milan, Italy, Nat Hentoff wrote, "Unlike some of the current avant-gardists, these three do not sound as if their souls had been lost in some computer. This is music with flesh, blood, sinew, fire, grace, and equally blessed, humor." As we listen to the title track from Common Goal, written by Lindbergh, let's also listen to him talk about the times in which it was created.
That was a very special time in the 70s, early 80s. It was, you know, the so-called loft jazz era. Musicians were really running the scene much more than club owners or presenters. And it was really about creativity. I mean, if you came to town and were really playing something with a unique voice, that was really respected and supported, and as opposed to, well, gee, why aren't you playing, you know, within this parameter or within these strict rules or something. It was, you know, it was a much more liberal and open time. It was just great. I feel very fortunate to have so-called come of age musically in that period and in that environment.
In Los Angeles, for Notes from the Western Edge, I'm Richard Paskey. Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed the show. Next month, tune in for some quartets from very different quarters. In Los Angeles, for Notes from the Western Edge and Fresh Ears Media, I'm Richard Paskey. Until next time, keep listening.